It's the ALA Midwinter Review this week, and we look forward to hearing about what's in that very special issue, as well as some related library news from Penguin. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in CCC's podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally. Each week, CCC's Beyond the Book speaks with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for an early look at the news that publishers, editors, authors, agents, and librarians will all talk about when they return to work on Monday. Joining me first on the show, as always, is Andrew Albanese in New York, PW's features editor. Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Hey, Chris. Good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you back. I understand there's some news that you can tell us about, but you can't tell us about. This is the Publisher of the Year issue.
That's right. December 5th is our Publisher of the Year issue, and we're just a little bit early for me spilling the beans on who that is this year. But read PW Daily later today. We'll name him there, him or her, I should say, and also all the other notables. And all I can say right now is it's an interesting choice, as are the other notables we've named, and it's sure sparked some discussion this year.
Well, it's been a heck of a year for publishing, so it will be very revealing, I think, about what PW thinks of the year past and as far as who you've chosen. Publishers this year have faced a lot of challenges, and certainly the Publisher of the Year must be someone who kind of not only rises to the challenge, but rises above it as well.
Exactly.
And this is, as well, the ALA Midwinter Preview, and that gives us an opportunity to talk about some library-related news from Penguin.
That's right. This is one of our biggest issues of the year, actually. Monday's issue, in addition to Publisher of the Year, is going to have 15 pages dedicated to libraries in anticipation of the ALA Midwinter Meeting, which comes up, I believe, on January 20th. It kicks off. And to no one's surprise, ebooks are going to be a subject of this package. So, you know, let me say first, I want to thank Penguin for really stepping in it and giving me a nice hook. They changed their ebook lending policy just before Thanksgiving and drew an outcry from librarians. Now, no one would be surprised that Penguin might change its ebook policy, because ebooks lending in libraries, it's a challenging issue these days. But the way they did it really highlighted some problems. They did it without warning. They did it without notice or consultation or without explanation. They pulled their entire front list ebook titles from their library lending program, and in a brief statement, all they would do is cite murky security concerns as the reason. And they still haven't elaborated on what those concerns are. So by now, the story is pretty well known, so I won't bother recapping it, except to say that almost every observer has noted that the move is surely some kind of pushback against Amazon. I mean, really, what isn't these days, right? But at this point, I will note a few things about this episode. First, for all the talk about communication and dialogue between libraries and publishers, things actually seem to have gotten worse. You've got publishers suing libraries, you've got authors suing libraries, and now Penguin comes out and really badly botches this ebook policy thing. You know, librarians will have to find out about the move on a Monday morning, mostly in response to patron complaints. There was no direct communication from Penguin, and Penguin still hasn't really come clean about why they're doing this. There was no consultation at all, and when they finally issued a statement, it told librarians, hey, don't worry, you can still buy our front list titles in print. Well, that might be the most tone-deaf line I've ever heard in my career covering publishing. You know, borrowing a print book is useless for all those people who will get Kindle Fires or other devices under their tree this year, and it's useless for librarians that now have to explain to their patrons why they can't meet their ebook demands. The other thing this highlighted is the kind of fundamental flaw in ebook lending, that is, that it's licensed managed access by a third party. In this case, it's OverDrive sitting in the middle between libraries and the patron. So, you know, look at it this way. Penguin could never just come in and pull all its print books off a library shelf. But that it can do so with ebooks managed through this third-party vendor, that should send chills up the spine of anyone who really values libraries. Because if we accept that ebooks are the future, we're accepting that libraries' ability to collect and curate these collections is going to be fundamentally affected. Now, one librarian on OverDrive's blog put it this way. This librarian had asked OverDrive about an unavailable Kindle book on behalf of the patron, and OverDrive replied that, hey, our catalog can change frequently depending on what the publisher says, and that can cause some titles to be no longer available. Now, you try explaining that to a patron. Our patrons are unhappy, the librarian noted. They want to know, and rightly so, why they are funding the leasing of frequently unusable content via frequently unusable product. And every library should be asking the same question. And this year at ALA, I think a lot of them will be.
Well, that's a subject that looks to get hotter in the winter, unlike most things, at least in the Northeast. Also, Andrew, you've got a feature coming up this week on two awards that have grown in stature rather than diminished, as so many awards have recently.
That's right. So we also were in the ALA issue. We have this great feature on the Newbery and Caldecott Awards. So you'll remember, I think it was in Frankfurt that you and I spoke about book awards a little bit, and how specifically how the man Booker was challenged and how people are starting to question the value of adult book awards. Suffice it to say, the Newbery and Caldecott Awards don't have that problem. You know, you can win a Pulitzer Prize and not sell a heck of a lot of books. But if you sell a Newbery or a Caldecott, even though they're for children's books, they have grown-up clout. You are going to sell books, and you are going to sell a lot of books.
And so, year after year after year.
That's right. These things stay in print for a long time. And some of these books don't age well because, you know, books from the 30s may have things about, you know, may have racism in them, et cetera. Things, values change over the years. But for the most part, they do sell very, very well. And the Newbery and the Caldecott may just be the most coveted awards in publishing. Also in this piece, we have two really interesting copyright-related pieces that I think that Copyright Clearance Center people are really going to enjoy. One is a great interview with two American University professors, Pat Oftahidi and Peter Yazzie. They've written a book about fair use published by the University of Chicago Press and how it's becoming more and more vital these days. You know, a lot of us have run into issues with copyright, I think, these days, whether it's trying to post a video to YouTube or getting blocked with something on Facebook, etc. Well, the authors make the point in this book the fair use is a vital, important part of our copyright tradition, yet these misperceptions that we have about how copyright works and these sort of machine-led filters have led people to sort of self-constrain their creativity. But we're now a country of makers, they know. We're sort of a remix culture, and a vibrant exercise of fair use can really help spur creativity. The other piece is a blistering critique of the Stop Online Piracy Act, also known as SOPA. That bill was recently introduced in Congress, and it's supported by the AAP as well as the entertainment industry. But it has attracted a groundswell of opposition. In this piece, Doctorow very eloquently argues, as he usually does, that the bill actually lays the groundwork for a sweeping sort of copyright-related regime of censorship, because if passed, it would, among other things, give the State Department the power to block access to sites, even though no court has found them to be illegal. So, you know, we can talk about how to best address piracy, but, you know, as Doctorow notes, and I tend to agree with him, the literary world should never come down on the side of censorship. And, you know, rounding out the issue, we have a contribution from the great Nancy Pearl and a really lovely profile of Random House's Marcia Purcell, who after 20 years is retiring. Now, Marcia was among the first, she was the first, actually, library outreach person, the dedicated marketing person for publishers related to libraries. Every publisher has that position now, so she's pioneered that. And at a time when communication between libraries and publishers is a little strained, Purcell shows, you know, we actually have a great tradition of talking and getting along.
Well, I look forward to reading that. I also look forward to seeing the coverage on those copyright pieces you mentioned, both about fair use and SOPA, as it happens, coming up in Washington, D.C. at the Newseum on December 12th. I'm going to be moderating a panel discussion with Maria Pawlenty, the new Register of Copyrights, with Victor Perlman, who's the general counsel at the American Society of Media Photographers, and with Cecilia Kang, who covers intellectual property issues and other policy-related matters for the Washington Post. And we're going to be talking about some of those very points, about SOPA, what it means, and about where fair use stands these days, as well as questions related to orphan work. So all of that very timely. We'll put some information about their program. It's a free program, both free webcast and free if you're in the Washington area. So maybe somebody from PW can join us, Andrew. We hope
I'll be there.
Oh, wonderful.
I'm delighted to hear that.
Well, that's a great surprise. Look forward to seeing you. Andrew Albanese, as always, thank you so much for your contribution. I want to turn now to Rose Fox, a PW Reviews editor who blogs at Genreville. As always, Rose, welcome back, and you've got more books to tell us about.
I do. It's really good to be back after the holiday weekend, and it's hard to believe we're so close to the year, but this is issue number 49 of 51, another 52 weeks in the year, but we're going to be taking a little more time off. There will not be a December 26th issue of PW. In the meantime, for issue 49, we have quite a few strong debuts this week. In fiction, we interviewed debut author Madeline Miller, who retold the Iliad in The Song of Achilles. She says the Iliad is always waiting in the wings, ready for a new generation to discover it. We also review Megan Mayhew Bergman's Birds of a Lesser Paradise, a debut novel with a melancholic tone that nonetheless gives a sense of possibility and rebirth. In science fiction, fantasy, and horror, we cover Throne of the Crescent Moon, which is the long-awaited debut novel from heralded short story author Saladin Ahmed, and its Arab-influenced setting will delight readers who are weary of pseudo-European epic fantasy. In romance, we review Miss Hillary School's a Scoundrel, which is Samantha Grace's rich and winning Regency romance debut. And in comics, we go way back to the 1940s. It's Pogo Volume 1 of the complete syndicated comic strips. And obviously, this is not the first book of Walt Kelly's comic strips, but it does include his long-ago comics debut.
Well, Rose, I have to tell you, I'm a fan. It's a guilty pleasure of mine. Pogo is a terrific strip, very inventive, very influential. It's been gone for quite some time, but I think lots of cartoonists have really been shaping their careers by what Walt Kelly was up to, and so I look forward to getting that book myself, I think.
Well, that's just what the review says, actually, that even from these early strips, you can immediately see how influential Kelly's work was on the cartoonists who followed him. So it's there's a lot of good information in there about Kelly's life as well as his work. So I definitely recommend picking that up if you're a fan.
Right. I think it would be fair to say that Gary Trudeau would have had an entirely different career if it weren't for Walt Kelly kind of breaking the path of adding politics into the cartoon.
Yeah, he'd probably be in Congress. Poor guy.
Well, that would be too bad. We wouldn't be able to read him every day. So what have you got coming up as well in fiction?
Well, of course, we have some books by experienced authors as well. So in mainstream fiction, we highlight Helen Simpson's collection, In Flight Entertainment. Our reviewer says she is one of the finest contemporary short story writers. And in mysteries and thrillers, we have side-by-side father and son reviews. That doesn't happen every day. We cover Michael Palmer's Oath of Office, a suspenseful scientific thriller, and his son, Daniel Palmer's Helpless, which boasts superbly crafted characters and catchy prose. And I can reveal that Christmas might be a little tense in their household because one of them got a starred review and the other did not.
Well, you can't win all the time. What about in your nonfiction section? There's a biography or coming out on someone who we probably all ought to know the name but don't.
That's right. Juliet Gordon-Lowe. I bet very few of us know that name, but we're about to. We have both a review of Stacey A. Cordery's biography of Juliet Gordon-Lowe, who founded the Girl Scouts, and we also have a Q&A with Cordery, who discusses what led her to write that biography and what makes Lowe such a really interesting figure. We also cover two very strong books on the Middle East. We have A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, by foreign policy expert Trita Parsi, and Liberation Square, Inside the Egyptian Revolution and the Rebirth of a Nation, by Egyptian-American journalist Ashraf Khalil. And those are both very topical right now, obviously. And this week we have a lifestyle section, which includes a review of a 600-page hardcover cookbook, The River Cottage Fish Book, by Hugh Fernley Whittingstall and Nick Fisher, which is a truly comprehensive volume that discusses the health benefits of fish and offers guides to sustainable shopping as well as recipes. And in children's picture books, we highlight Baby Bear Sees Blue by Ashley Wolfe, which our reviewer calls both cozy and dramatic, and Looking at Lincoln by Mara Kalman, an analog version of Kalman's New York Times illustrated column, In Love with A. Lincoln. And in middle grade and young adult fiction, we cover The Funny and Subversive Earwig and the Witch by the late Diana Wynne Jones, with spot illustrations by Paul O. Zielinski.
Well, Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville, thanks as always for a great roundup of the latest books reviewed in Publishers Weekly.
Always a pleasure.
And Andrew Albanese there in New York covering the latest news for Publishers Weekly as its features editor for us. Thank you again.
Thank you, Chris.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs. Follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. We're here every Friday with a wrap-up of the news of the week and the week ahead with the folks at PW Publishers Weekly. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.